I would say that generally, as women, when we talk to people, we are more precise towards our product. We know all the flaws of our product. So we tend to be more humble, while men, if they have to sell a product, and they are not humble at all. So I think at the beginning of this journey, I was also more humble. But later with time, I understood that you must have conviction, because if you don't believe in something, nobody else is going to do that.
Welcome to Hello 5050 World, the podcast where we break tech bubbles before they break us, and where we talk to people who make tech more humane. Today's conversation on the Hello 5050 World podcast is with Alessia Paccaniella. Alessia is a former colleague of mine, and she's now the co-founder at Wipeflow, a tech startup backed by Y Combinator, a large US-based startup funder. We'll be talking about her journey, obviously, from Italy to Switzerland to the US, from university. But Alessia studied at ETH Zurich to corporate world, and now to the probably pretty crazy AI startup world. We'll also talk about Alessia's startup Wipeflow, what problem the product solves, how it is built, and what's next. And Alessia will also share her experiences building a tech startup as a female founder in a very competitive and male-dominated field. Let's dive in. Welcome, Alessia, to the Hello 5050 World podcast.
Thank you, Lisa. It's very nice to be here.
So you've just come back from the US, right? And what has your last month of your life looked like?
Pretty crazy. So the last month I was in San Francisco, and I was living in this hacker house in San Francisco at a friend's hacker house. So they built this very nice place where they have a lot of builders that live and work in the same place. And yeah, I mean, I went there for mainly business and work. And I have to say that San Francisco's vibe is always very energetic, and it gives a lot of energy and motivation. It was pretty crazy.
And what have you been doing in San Francisco this time?
So we're developing a new product right now, and it was mostly understanding, talking to users and going to events and try to make users test the platform and understanding user testing, basically. So
very cool. We'll talk about your product afterwards as well a little bit, but I quickly want to stay a bit on this life that you have now, right, between Switzerland and the US, so you travel a lot back and forth. Has there been also moments in this crazy journey where you thought, well, how did I end up here?
Yes, every day. If I think about 2 years ago, or the 2 years ago version of me, I wouldn't recognize myself, because I was a very, it was very planning. So I was planning everything in my life, and I was trying to understand what I would do every day of my life for the next 6 to 12 months. And now I live much more day by day. And it's very nice because you don't have to be attached to a specific plan, and you can just modify the plan accordingly to what your needs are. I, of course, have my routine here in Zurich, and I have my routine in San Francisco. I have a support system in both places, and so it's very easy to switch between one and the other. But I really like that I can just move around, and I don't have to stick to one place just because maybe, you know, I have a job and I have to go to the office every day. So I think that I really like it. So it's crazy, but it's not so stressful to me. It gives me a lot of energy, and it makes me feel fulfilled.
Very nice. I'm happy to hear that. We first met through our job in the corporate world, basically, and you also are now building a YC-backed startup. So how was that transition? Did you always imagine being a founder when you were smaller?
Actually, no. I always had very big ambitions in my life, but I didn't have the dream of becoming a founder. I think I had the dream of doing something big. Since I was a child, I always had this vision of me doing big things. And I think it came also from my parents. They always installed this sort of like mentality in us, in me and my brothers as well. And founder's life was just a way to reach that goal, I think. But it didn't have to be. I considered different paths. One of them was also like a PhD. At the end, I ended up in founding a company. But it didn't have to be that.
Cool. So you grew up in Italy, right? And also with a few brothers. So how was that growing up and now also moving to Switzerland and the US?
So I lived in Italy for the first 21 years of my life, yes. Italy is amazing and I love Italy. I miss Italian food mostly and the culture as well. So I really miss Italian culture. But I have to say that when I go back, I don't miss so much the mentality because I feel like, I don't want to generalize, of course, but there is still this mentality of living a lot, like finding a job and then just following the path that the society gives you and not doing more. So it's very few people that want to do more. And I am very surprised because in the last year, I met a lot of people from Padova. Padova is my hometown that somehow managed to do more. Like, I don't know, I met a guy that is very, very high right now in Anthropic, but he worked at Replit and he managed to do a lot of things at Replit. Then I met tons of Y Combinator people and yeah, some of them come from Padova. I met a lot of founders, international founders that come from Padova. So I'm very impressed by that, but they all moved away. So I would say, of course, there are always people that want to obtain more and yeah, that have higher goals. And yeah, they're just not in Padova anymore. They're just not in Italy anymore.
So this growth mindset probably also led you to studying in another country, right? So you moved to Switzerland to study at ETH. How was that experience?
Initially traumatizing. I remember I moved from Milan because I was studying in Milan to Zurich. And 6 months after COVID happened, so I had very, very few friends because I didn't manage to meet my friends. Also, ETH master is not that easy. So I was just concentrating on my studies and I was not going out and partying. So I didn't have many friends. Then COVID happened and I didn't meet anyone else for the rest of the master. So the master, from a social experience, was not really, really nice. But from a topic point of view, like what I had the opportunity to study, for me, it was amazing. Like I did the master in computer graphics and it's not that easy to find the master that is so focused on computer graphics and visual effects. And for me, it was my dream. Like I studied all the topics that I really, really loved. And I still remember everything that I studied because I was very, very passionate about it. So the experience itself was a bit traumatizing, but after COVID stopped and I came back, you know, to work and I also started a company and I met you, I think after that it was amazing and I fell in love with Zurich and I started building my life here. And yeah, now Zurich is home.
And after you did a small excursion into the corporate world, you returned back to ETH. Why was that?
Yes, I went back to ETH. Because ETH has a nice incubator, which is called Student Project House, where basically they want to give all the means to students to be able to build a business or start a startup. So they have this amazing building very close to ETH Centrum, where you can just go every day and you can stay 24/7 in the building just working. And they have coaches and they provide all the support that you need. And the ecosystem, because the people at the end build the ecosystem. And this is, I think, where my mentality was formed to become a founder, because I learned a lot from all the people around me. So I went back there because I had a friend actually that just introduced me to the place. And I also couldn't stop going there. So I was spending initially, of course, like all my weekends and then full time, all my weeks as well there. Just working on projects until I found the right project.
So there you also kind of found your tribe, the people that also had this growth mindset.
Exactly, yes.
And then how did this happen that you found the idea for Wipeflow at the end?
It was a very iterative process. We started out from a very different domain, which was biotech, because my co-founder, she studied data science, but she was mostly analyzing data for cancer treatments and everything related to biotech. So we started out with an idea in that space, and I'm genuinely curious about a lot of stuff, so I was very open to that. But after a while, we realized that it was too early for that idea because, it was a very researchy idea. And, you know, pharma are very slow and it's not the easiest market to start with. So since we both had a background in AI and tech and software development, we just started validating a lot of problems and analyzing the market and understanding where something could fit. And we saw that there was this boom of vibe coding tools just coming out. And so we read a lot of things online and we talked to a lot of users and we pinpointed all the issues. And then we formulated an idea around this. We applied to YC with just an idea because we had a prototype that we built in like 1 week and that we tested, of course, with users, but we didn't really have a product that was launched yet. And we got into YC.
Congratulations. Thank you. That's amazing. Can you quickly share a bit about Y Combinator for people that maybe are not familiar with?
Yeah, so Y Combinator is a startup incubator. It's the best in the world. They initially invest $500,000 in your company. And you basically they fly you to San Francisco for 2.5 months, 10 weeks. They provide you, again, with all the support from partners. So there are general partners that have regular meetings with you and they advise you. And then, of course, they put you in contact with all the network, the amazing network of YC. They organize events with the huge people like Branceschi or Sam Altman or, yeah, incredible people of the Silicon Valley ecosystem. And at the end of the 10 weeks, there is demo day. So you present in front of tons of investors and you raise your round. So basically you raise your investment round. After the 2.5 months, Y Combinator finishes, but in reality it doesn't stop because it just continues living with you. Because at the end you are in contact with your batchmates and they're going to be friends for life. Of course, it's a very stressful period of time, so you bond a lot. And I'm still in contact with all my friends from YC, and I can still just meet my general partner and ask for advice and use the network for anything that I do with my company.
Very interesting. And when we talk about your product, Wipeflow, can you, in a few sentences, explain what it does and what problem it solves?
Yeah, so at a higher level, Wipeflow allows non-technical people to build. And to build many things because the product evolved a lot. So now we have several products. Initially, we started out as I said, like a vibe coding tool. So it allowed non-technical people to build full stack applications. And then it evolved into more. So it could allow to build automations and automations with the front end and incredible UIs for your website. And right now, I told you like we are launching a new product. So we allow anyone to create graphical assets or marketing assets. That means anything that can go from posters to ads to carousels to pricing proposal documents, project documents, all on brand, basically automating the generation of the assets that your company needs for growth. And this is a huge problem that every founder has, me as well, because I need to post a lot on social media and I need to post a lot of growth content and I never have time to do that and I don't have a designer. So it takes me a lot of time. So I am the new user of my new platform as well. And that's super cool.
So I guess because you're also a software developer, right? So even at the beginning of Wipeflow, you were basically solving a problem that you had yourself, right? So it's probably quite exciting to be building a product that you want to use yourself as well.
Yes, but I wouldn't say I was the ICP of the initial product. I am now with this new product, but the initial product was mostly targeting really non-technical people to unlock something, like to allow them the possibility to be creative. That's the mantra, like allow anyone to be creative without the obstacle of knowing how to code. And that's not super easy because you have to simplify a very complex domain. And yeah, it's not super easy, but I think it's very nice because it's like teaching, you know? And you have to reach a level of simplicity, which is almost given.
I quickly want to stay a bit on Wipeflow because, of course, I also work in software development, so I'm interested to learn a bit more about this platform that you're building. Mm-hmm. You are the developer of this as well, right? How did you do this? Did you also use vibe coding to code the product?
Yeah, of course. I think, of course. Like we use tons of vibe coding. We got tons of credits from many, many companies to use their tools. And we develop all the time with vibe coding tools. But of course, you need... So I don't think I would have been able to do this if I didn't have experience in software development before, especially in web development. Why? Because you need to put a proper architecture of the software. Otherwise, the vibe coding tool does a mess. And it just keeps duplicating code and creating vulnerabilities of code. Like, it's really, really bad. So you must have anyways full control over the architecture of the software. And then after the architecture is set up, then you can start prompting and maybe review the PRs, you know, that the agent opens. But you always have to have some level of control over the code because otherwise it is not okay to just like put a product out without knowing if there are vulnerabilities, if the data of the users are secured, and so on. So
here we're probably also touching on a bit of a tension point with any vibe coding tools that are out there. As software developers ourselves, we know that vibe coding has a lot of potential risks, but we also build products for anyone to create tools and websites. How does Vibeflow deal with this?
You have to put a lot of guardrails around. With the full stack and automation product, it was more difficult. So for example, with the automation product, how we solved this was really by creating components. So parameterized components. If you use components, you can only allow changing the parameterization of these components, but you cannot really change the body and the core of these components. And this is how we put guardrails. And now with this new product, it's not really a problem, because at the end it's just the creation of like front end and UI elements components, so that's okay. But in general, it's a pretty complicated problem, and there are tons of companies right now that are doing AI tools for security. So yeah, assessing the security of AI generated code.
I think we're also still in the process of taking control or regulating AI in a way that it can be used safely by anyone, really. I think there's this vision and promise that this is possible, but would you also say that we're not quite there yet?
I think it's incredible what happened in the last year. 1 year ago, I started using Claude Code. And before that, I don't even know how I did it without. But yeah, 1 year ago, I started using Claude Code. And now it's basically impossible to live without it. I think, of course, we're going to improve a lot. And I don't know what's going to happen in the next 4 years. We're going to reach AGI, if not already. But yeah, there is always going to be the need, I think, of a human in the loop. Probably it's going to have a marginal role, but there is always going to be the need of a responsible person checking.
Mm-hmm. And also a person that understands how it works under the hood, right?
Yeah. But you know, like right now they're developing softwares for agents. So basically sort of like a Jira for agent, meaning that there is a master agent that handles the team of sub-agents, and that's incredible. Because it's like a scrum master that just, you know, organizes the sprint for the sub agents. That's a concept that to me is incredible.
Do you have an example of a user or a customer that has been using Vibeflow and what kind of products they're building with it?
Yeah, for the automation platform, it was super cool because we had growth companies that were creating a lot of tools for their customers to basically, they wanted to handle their customers a front end, meaning a dashboard where they could see basically their metrics and any deliverable from the company to the client in this customized dashboard. And this is the core of it. Like, you can build customized software for your customers and just display any data, any real data. So you can fetch, you can call any API, and then you can call any agent to process the data. And you can save anything in the database or read from any database as well. And this is unlocking so many possibilities. Just imagine any kind of business that has to interface themselves with a customer, and they don't have a way to handle the deliverable in a good way. Now you can just give this unified deliverable with everything on it. And that goes, I mean, we were focusing on growth companies and we have tons of use cases there, but that goes from, you know, wedding planners to any kind of business. And that to me is very, very cool. We also saw some users building bots. And not only bots for like iMessage, but also bots with an admin panel where they could control all the settings of the bot. So you can really build any kind of tool with it. That depends on if you choose to be very horizontal or focus on a specific use case.
I can really see how your eyes, they light up when you talk about it. So very cool. I remember when I first learned about Vibeflow, I think what really I found intriguing was at the time, there were already a lot of tools out there to build just the front end part, but they were very bad at integrating with the back end or with databases and so on. And so with Vibeflow, you were filling a bit of this gap, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is still a problem because now most of the vibe coding tools out there, they are integrating back ends and so on. But it's still an issue because of the visualization layer, in my opinion. So anytime that a user doesn't know what he's doing, as I say, in the front end, you have feedback, immediate feedback, but in the back end, you have no idea what's happening. And so unless you absolutely test the whole platform end to end, it's very, very hard to understand what's happening. While with the visualization layer on top, you can just understand exactly and simulate every single workflow and understand what's happening from the input to the output. So that's for sure still a problem and still unresolved.
So there's still a lot of work for you to do.
Yes.
Cool. I want to quickly come back to your life in San Francisco and in general, like the Silicon Valley startup world, because I think for us, sometimes being here in Switzerland, the ecosystem is very different. It's hard to imagine how this must be. Can you share a little bit more the differences between Switzerland and Silicon Valley for you?
So I love Switzerland, and I think there is a very cool ecosystem here in Zurich as well, but I would say mostly for robotics and deep tech startups. So I would say that's the focus here. In San Francisco, everything is super fast and everyone is very, very hyped. So first of all, if you talk about, you go to a bar and you are sitting next to an investor and a potential customer and Sam Altman probably. So it's very easy to meet people and they're all in the same bubble. So it's very hard to find people that are not in the tech startup bubble. But I also like that everyone believes in what you're doing there. So as soon as you start doing something, everyone hypes you up and wants to help you. So there is this very nice culture in the Silicon Valley specifically of everyone helping each other. And this is really something that I noticed when I arrived there. I don't think it's a matter of opportunism in the sense that I do a favor to you and you're going to do it to me. But it's really a cultural or like a founder cultural thing where, of course, like I don't remember who did the last favor, but I'm going to keep doing favors to you. And at some point, you're going to do a favor to me. And this is something also Paul Graham, which is the founder of Y Combinator, talked about in a very nice talk he did in Stockholm like a month ago. And I think it's super true. It's really, really true. The amount of help that I received when I was there and when I am there is really, really huge. So that's for sure one thing. And then the other thing is that it's very easy to for people to use your tool. Like it's very easy to sell to people because they are less risk adverse than here in Europe in general. And that is also true for investors so much. Investors in Europe are very more hard to convince. Investors in the US, they're just very fast and they are more prone to risk and that just speeds you up, you know? So I would say that those are the main differences.
Do you also see some downsides of the hype in San Francisco?
So downsides, I mean, as I said, it's a bubble. So sometimes you risk to only see the perspective of the bubble. And you have to understand that San Francisco is 3 years ahead. So what happens in San Francisco is happening now. It's probably going to arrive in Europe in a long time, you know? So if you only listen to the feedback of San Francisco, you risk to think you're never enough because San Francisco moves so fast that every day there is a new competitor and a new company and you risk to die.
And so how do you make sure that with Wipeflow you're not falling into that risk?
By keeping going back and forth. Yeah. No, I think just by talking to users. So of course, like we talk a lot to users like all around the world because we have users from everywhere in the world. But also, I mean, we have families and we have networks in Italy, in France, because my co-founder is from France, in Switzerland, and of course, then we have a network in San Francisco as well.
And can you share a little bit about this hacker house that you mentioned at the beginning? How is that?
Yeah, so, I mean, they are friends from Zurich that also joined Y Combinator, and we just happened to be hosted by them when we were there. And it's crazy because, you know, on a Friday night, you don't feel bad if you're not going out because everyone is working. And so it's just, I don't know if you watch The Office. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's sort of like similar vibes, like you're always there working and it starts being funny to spend all the time there. And it's also, I think I would say it's super motivating because of course you're not spending time with average people, but you're spending time with the top of the notch people. Like they're really, really good. And you learn so much by being surrounded by a team, you know, of another fast growing startup. And yeah, I really loved it. It was just very, very fun. Also, they have a sauna in the garden and they live very close to the Golden Gate Bridge. So it was a very nice experience, yes.
Mm-hmm. And how many other women are in this bubble in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, not many. I mean, me and my co-founders, we are both women. I think that's very rare. There were, I think, other two teams in Y Combinator that were only women founded. But yeah, the majority of the teams were mostly men. I would say that was not a problem during my community, because everyone was super nice and nobody really made that feel weird inside the Y Combinator ecosystem. But of course, outside there are always people that are just happy to comment or, yeah, just be negative and attack.
Mm-hmm. You're also active on social media, right? You probably have to, in a way, as well as a founder in this world. How is that experience for you in general?
At the beginning, I was a bit scared because I was not used to post so much. But yeah, LinkedIn works super well for us. I think LinkedIn loves the story because I think we have a very inspiring story and people started to know us for our story. And so they want to support. And LinkedIn is generally very, very positive social media. But then it depends because there is also Twitter. And Twitter, we're good on Twitter, but Twitter is more mean, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so it depends on which social media you use. Yeah, I'm not scared anymore of posting. And I just like, it comes very natural now, right now. And it's super nice because the worst thing for a startup is for nobody to know you. Mm-hmm. And the moment you start, you have a good storytelling and you just share anything that goes from founder's life to the product updates, you don't know who you're reaching. And of course, the algorithm does its magic and reaches the right people. And that helps you in anything with the product and the company. So I think, yeah, that's very cool. Everyone should post much more.
And so you said it was a bit of a journey of like getting used to also probably building a company in public, right? So you share a lot, yes, about founder's life and so on. How did you also deal with that emotionally for yourself?
Yeah, it's a roller coaster, but I think I learned so much to become stable in the like instability. During the Y Combinator batch last summer, it was harder because you're running a super stressful sprint and you don't sleep, you don't do sport. It's very stressful and you're always working home with your co-founder. So I think in those 2 months and a half, that was harder. But after that, I think you just get used to it because you have to, right? So the priority is the company. You want the company to succeed. There are a lot of emotions. But it's good also to have a co-founder for that, because when you're up, then maybe she's down. And when you're down, she's up. And so it's a journey. But I think I became super, super resilient with time. At the beginning, it was harder. But with time, I got used to it. And also, like, you know, you start caring much less about things you cared more before, especially the outside world. You start caring much less because you don't have the capacity to do that. And you realize that it's not useful at all. Even if you want to get feedback on your product, and you just need to put out things. So you're for sure going to reach some kind of like, negative feedback or anything that goes against you, right? But it's good because that's the only way you learn. So I would say my mindset changed a lot.
And how do you sort through the noise? Like, how do you actually recognize the feedback that you're getting from the outside world that is reasonable and valuable for you?
You have to run user testing and user interviews in a specific way. So I don't know if you know the MOM test, but yeah, it's a framework on how to conduct these user interviews. And if you ask the questions in a right way, then you don't bias the user, basically. So if you ask questions, you don't have to have confirmation bias, basically. So you have to ask questions in a way that allows them to respond, not because they want to make you happy, but because they really, you know, are responding to the question. So yeah, it's a very nice book and I keep reading it because I always forget. I think that's for sure one thing. And then you have to understand who your ICP is and conduct interviews based on the ICP. So targeted interviews. And of course, some interviews are not going to be targeted because they're going to be inbound. So you cannot control those, but you really need to nail down who the person is in front of you. So the first thing you do in an interview is asking everything possible about what the person does, who the person is, what tool the person uses, what background the person has, and so on. And this is super important for removing the noise.
Would you also say that you're spending a bit more time now on these sort of user interviews than actually on building the product?
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. Like what you should do, okay, you should either always talk to users or either always build a product. But I think right now in this world, software is getting less and less value. And it's all about distribution. And how do you nail distribution? By knowing exactly who your user is and what are the problems. So it's super important to talk to users. And we do that more and more every day. And I understand, like, I also became much better with time, because at the beginning I was like, yes, but I don't know how to ask questions. Why would I need to ask these kind of questions? But the more you go deep, the more you learn and the more advantage you have compared to your competitors. Because it doesn't make any sense to make a product if you don't know what problem it solves, who uses it, and who is the user that keeps coming back and for what. So that's super, super important.
And along the way, you already touched a bit on this. As a female founder, it might sometimes feel a bit harder to build. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend to someone who still wants to do it? Like the support systems, or are there some tricks? What?
For sure, a support system, for sure. That's super important. I would say also try to find other female founders, you know, just sympathize with. I think, so something happened once that was like a post where they were just commenting about us being women and us, Y Combinator, having a quota system and equality criteria. And in the moment, of course, you don't, like, I read all the comments, which I shouldn't have, like, it's not useful, okay? So don't read this kind of content, but if you do, in the moment, it feels bad. But after that, you realize it's very stupid. But I would say that in those moments, just use that as an advantage, because they're going to talk about you and they give you publicity. So just use that and maybe ride that wave. So what I would do if I would go back in time would be to repost that post and just make it very funny or just like, yeah, ride the wave. Because it's not important and nobody cares and the world keeps spinning and nobody cares at the end. If you are talented and you believe in what you're doing, the world is going to notice. And it doesn't matter what people think. Of course, it's harder because people believe less in you somehow. At least the majority of not intelligent people. But there are tons of people that actually do believe in you. And that's so amazing. And I think, especially now, like in 2026, so many people, they don't even question, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, and they just support you no matter what. And so many people actually want to support you exactly because you're a woman.
Do you have like a personal experience or a story that you can share that illustrates that a bit?
I would say that generally as women, when we talk to people, we are more precise towards our product. We know all the flaws of our product. So we tend to be more humble. While men, if they have to sell a product, and they are not humble at all. So I think at the beginning of this journey, I was also more humble. But later with time, I understood that you must have conviction, because if you don't believe in something, nobody else is going to do that. So I would say I had some episodes where it was my fault because I somehow was too humble. And then I compared myself to other batchmates and I saw how they were talking and how they were acting. And I was like, okay, Alessia, like, change your attitude. And then I changed it and everything changes, because it's like you manifest the outcome at the end. So I would say, yes, an episode where when this happened, was it was my fault. So I talked in a way that should have been different. That's the point.
Mm-hmm. I would maybe challenge a little bit that it was your fault. I think there's a lot of factors that go into that, right? Also how we grow up or how we're told to behave in a way, even when we're small girls, right? We get told maybe already there, or we get feedback that will draw us into that direction. So mm-hmm. Not sure it was your fault, but I think it is really important as women to be aware of that there is this tendency to be a bit more too honest at times, mm-hmm. especially in the founder world, right? This is now that you've learned that, and I can really see this, that you have this sort of attitude of like go-getter and just like, let's make it happen. Do you also see yourself as a role model for others?
I think, of course, like, I think I am already. And what I always tend to do is when people open up with me about, yeah, their future, whether they're insecure about changing path or deciding on a career decision, I always want to absolutely help them. I was at a wedding the other day and I spent like 1 hour talking to a girl that was struggling with this. And I really, like, it becomes sort of my goal to help them, because I went through it and I really want them to see that there is like there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and there is, you can do anything and nobody cares. That's the message. Nobody cares. You can do anything with your life and nobody cares. So I would say, yes, I hope so. And I also love to help. Anytime that people write me on LinkedIn, for example, and I have like a lot of messages from LinkedIn people that maybe want help with the YC application, or they want just to meet me and talk a bit. If I have the capacity, I tend to help them, because I went through it and I just want them to not go through it or just have someone else's opinion.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You're definitely a role model. At least you are a role model to me. I think it's fascinating to also follow your journey from the university to corporate world and now in the startup world. And I think I also would encourage you to keep sharing and keep shining your light to the world. We'll now dive into the rapid fire questions. Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. Okay, so the first question is, I mean, of course, you are writing code, but if you could rewrite code in another product, any product of your choice, what would you do?
I would change the algorithm of the search function in the MacBook. Because I never find any file in my computer.
Yeah, all right. Very specific, but that's cool. I hope Apple is listening. All right, for the second one, what's an everyday act of allyship that anyone can do?
I think maybe giving more responsibilities to women in general, like believe in them, just believe in them more, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was also your experience. That's missing.
That builds up their confidence as well.
Yeah, cool. Love that. And whose voices do you think tech needs to hear more from?
Female founders. I would love to hear so many more stories of female founders. And I heard some of them during YC, and it was super inspiring.
Cool. And then we'll wrap it up with the last one. It's, if listeners remember just one single thing from this whole conversation, what should it be?
Well, try Vibeflow. I would say just don't think that the path is already written, and I would say you're always able to take action on your life and just do what you're passionate about and what you believe in, and you're going to succeed. Persist in that and you're going to succeed.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alessia, for this wonderful conversation, and all the best for the future.
Thank you, Lisa.
Really loved catching up with Alessia today and hearing about her life as a startup founder between Silicon Valley and Switzerland. What stuck with me first and foremost is, of course, so inspiring to see a young woman just going for her dream of building something big. And I'm very excited to see where this journey is going for Alessia and her co-founder and her current startup, Vibeflow. Another thing that stuck with me is also that surrounding yourself with the right people, finding the ecosystems and environments where you can fulfill your dreams, whether that's founding a company or something else, is really important. And the interesting distinction between Silicon Valley and Zurich, where, of course, Silicon Valley in itself is also a bubble, but if you find the right people and you manage to sort through the noise and recognize the signal, it can really help you grow a lot. Also, what sets you apart when building a product or when founding a company is not so much the actual building of it, but also understanding what problem you're solving. And I love how Alessia explained that through the user interviews and through understanding who they're building for. And then last but not least, very important that we hear more stories of female founders in tech, because there are not a lot of them out there, but the stories, at least that I know, and the story of Alessia showed that as well, are really inspiring, and they can be the spark that maybe someone is looking for. Thank you all so much for tuning in today and for listening to this episode. If you have any thoughts on what Alessia shared or what we talked about, let us know in the comments or write us an email to podcast@hello5050.world. We also love to hear from you on Patreon. If you're not supporting us yet, really encourage you to do that there. We are interacting with you on the podcast episodes. And there's also an episode specifically coming just for the Patreon members, a reflection on some of the previous episodes that we'll be doing. And we'd love to hear from you, actually, questions that you have or things that we should discuss in this episode that we call Retrospective, which is coming soon. If someone should listen into this and hear Alessia's story, please forward them this podcast. And to end, leaving you with a question for reflection. How many women do you have in your environment, in tech, that you believe in and that you want to support? And how often do you let them know about this? Thank you so much, and until next time.